And we ran this organization for 4 years. And after about 4 years, you know, I don't know if you know anything about Kathmandu, but it's one of the most polluted places. And Christina, who was running the situation, started getting a kind of emphysema from living there. And I said to her, you know, look, you got to come back to the States. So we went to this woman, Aruna Upreti, who ran this organization called REST. And we said, Aruna, is it possible that we could incorporate the Bahini Foundation under the auspices of REST, and you can continue running this foundation the way we were running it? And Aruna said, yes, she would love to do it. At the time, we had maybe 20 children living in our house. In the last, you know, we got a phone call from Aruna about a year and a half ago, who told us that because we started the Bahini Foundation, which was the first organization of its kind in Nepal, it saved the lives of about 10,000 children.
Wow.
And it was extraordinary. You know, I mean, it sent chills through my body when I heard this.
Mm-hmm.
And at any rate, what happened was, is, you know, we did a video called My Name is Gita for the purposes of raising awareness and raising money. And the video was shown all over Asia. It was about 4 or 5 minutes long, promotional video, but very beautiful. Chris is an extraordinary singer, and she sang on the video, and I wrote these songs and everything. And at any rate, I saw the video, and I had also had, you know, I had also met people that were part of the Bahini Foundation that had lived in brothels in India, specifically in Mumbai on a place called Falkland Road. And when I heard the stories of how 12-year-old children were raped, tortured, brainwashed, drugged, and transformed into machines that would sleep with 20 men a day, it was so horrible to me. In my own head, it became the most horrific crime of the 20th century. And I said to myself, you got to do something. So I sat down and I wrote this book, Little Sisters. It came out of me like a force of nature.
And Little Sisters, it's a novel,
yes,
that personalizes, yes, what you're talking about. Because, well, I think people, when we start talking about human trafficking and sex trafficking of children, it is, as you said, you know, about the most horrific crime one can imagine. Mm-hmm. And I think that when we start talking about things that are so horrific, people numb out, right?
Exactly.
And tune out. And it becomes this sort of major problem. Okay, there's, oh my gosh, 10,000, 20,000, 100,000 girls, you know, being trafficked. And what can I do about it? You know, but, and they're faceless. But your novel really, it personifies.
Well, what I tried
issue.
To do is make it palatable. I knew that if I wrote 200 pages just describing how these, what's done to these kids, nobody would read it. But I said, okay, Stuart, make it a love story. Make it a family story. Make it something that takes you to the exotic East. You know, make it almost a travelogue in a way, you know, and make it something that somebody can read and it becomes a page turner. It's a mystery story. It's a suspense story. You know, it has all these elements.
It has all
to
those
it.
Elements. Uh-huh.
And I said, this is something somebody can read. And then in the reading of it, you begin to discover what is done to these children. And it and basically most people that pick it up can't put it down. They say, you know, it just takes them right to the end. But I wrote it that way because I wanted it to be something that is palatable. You know, it's a story of a Western man married to a girl in Nepal, et cetera, et cetera. And it becomes very interesting that way.
And so in looking at the global scale, and this is a global problem, and I think a lot of times folks in the U.S. Try to put it as it's a problem that happens elsewhere. But in fact, it happens everywhere, including the U.S., including Portland.
Yeah, let's take it globally, okay? Globally, there are 27 million people being trafficked today. It's a $32 billion industry, $32 billion industry today. In the United States, the figures are between 200,000 and 300,000 children or people are being trafficked into sexual slavery today. Mm-hmm. In Portland, I've been told there are at least 2,000 to 3,000 young girls that are living in sexual slavery today.
So, and again, that's a staggering number of human lives affected in this criminal behavior.
It's staggering, and as I said, to me, probably the most horrific crime of the 21st century. And I think part of my, you know, outrage, is that I just find myself having to raise awareness about this. People have to know about this, that this is not something that is just going on in Kathmandu and, you know, on Falkland Road in India. It is something that's happening in neighborhoods right here in Portland.
Exactly so. And we have tomorrow at the First Unitarian Church, there is a day-long forum, community forum, Child Sex Trafficking in Portland. This event is hosted by the First Unitarian Church and the Little Sisters Foundation. And it is, again, tomorrow starting at 3 p.m. Can you tell us a little bit about what's happening tomorrow, Stu, at the First Unitarian?
Yeah, it's going to be divided into three or four segments. The first segment will be Amanda Marshall, the state attorney, is going to be talking. And also Carolyn Tomei, who's an assemblywoman, is going to be talking. And they're like going to be plenary speakers introducing this whole thing. After that, there's going to be a panel consisting of myself, the ADA, I think his name is AJ J.R.
Ujifusa.
Ujifusa, pardon me. and Mike Gallagher, who I once did a program here with him, with you.
Yes, I spoke with him the first time we spoke. Yeah. He's from the Portland Police Bureau Human Trafficking Division.
And then there's going to be kind of like an intermission for about an hour. And there are going to be 10 or so different tables set up by different NGOs in the Portland area. And people can be able to talk to them and get information and really find out what is going on in the Portland area directly from people that are doing on-the-ground work. Then after that, there's going to be a healing session, which Kate Law, and who's the Minister of Social Justice at the church, and myself are going to be performing. So that is really how the whole thing is going to go on for almost 4 hours.
And I love the idea of ending with a healing service. Mm. I think, again, as we are talking about things that are so horrific, and I keep trying to come up with another word because I hate being so repetitive, but I can't. I just really cannot come up with another one. When you actually take your blinders off and immerse yourself in the information that is out there that is so important, ending with something like a healing session seems like a very appropriate thing to do.
You know, Annie, I've been doing these events all over the country. And one of the things I've discovered about doing these events and from talking to so many people is this problem of human trafficking gets right back to a very basic reality. And it has to do with the dysfunction of families. It has to do with the lack of love and nurturing and nourishment that children find in their families. So these kids are looking for it, and they're looking for it on the streets. And these pimps come along, and you know, the media promotes all this, you know, jewelry and beautiful, and the prince, you know, these pimps come along and just promote this. They seduce these children. Mm-hmm. I'll give you jewelry, I'll make you, you know, money, this and that, you'll be beautiful.
You'll be my special girl.
My special girl, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And this is what's going on, and mostly children are looking for this because they don't get it at home. So the healing really has to do not just so much with healing society. It gets down to a much more personal level because all of us, we have children, we have grandchildren, we have, you know, and every one of these children could be at risk because this is something that crosses all socioeconomic boundaries. It's not just something that, you know, is racial or something of lower classes. It goes right into the malls in suburban America. It's everywhere, this thing.
And you mentioned economics as being a primary driving factor when we look at Nepal and when we look at it globally. I would actually put forward that economics is a driving factor here in the States as well. As you were mentioning, many of the young women, the girls that are trafficked are leaving horrific situations with their family, or very dysfunctional families, to say the least. Again, it becomes a matter of economics. If there were options for, you know, 15-year-old, 14-year-old girls who are in such serious trouble with their homes because their families are not taking care of emotional and or really some, you know, in many cases, any needs. If there was a place that was safe for them to go to, if there was a way of actually getting economic opportunities to girls who could be emancipated and start actually going forward with their own lives mm-hmm. from tragic family situations, that could be part of a solution, right? But in fact, what we find is sort of a more pervasive attitude of this family should work, you should stay at home, there's no resources otherwise. So
what you have is you have adults that are emotionally 7 years old mm-hmm, mm-hmm. who have children and then have to raise these children, and mostly children just kind of raise themselves. Mm-hmm. They just grow up. Mm-hmm. And all of that nurturing, that love, that security that comes when people truly can provide compassion and empathy and sit there and understand the problems and listen to each other, for God's right. sake. Right. Just simply listen to each other and provide just an environment that a child is secure to go to their parents mm-hmm. and say, look, I'm having these problems and I truly want to talk about them. And I trust that you will give me answers and help me to get through these problems. So what happens is the children have nowhere to go because mm-hmm. most of the adults are, as I said, emotionally, they're 7 years old. Yeah. You know, they...
Well, and beyond that, I had the opportunity to interview four women coming out of prostitution. And one of my questions was, how did this happen? What led you to this choice? And all four of them had talked about being abused physically and sexually in their homes by fathers or stepfathers, and having to leave to avoid that situation when they were 12. I think it was all four women left before they were 15. It was between 12 and 14. And so they leave their horribly abusive homes, where they've been raped and abused, and they find pimps who are going to continue that abuse. Mm. But it's familiar, and it seems like the only economic option, because where else can they go? And again, so it's a very complex problem. We're talking about economics, but we're also talking about rape culture. We're talking about sexism. We're talking about dysfunctionality in the family in general. Mm-hmm. We're talking about so many issues that come together here to create this perfect storm.
This is what has to be healed. Yeah. It gets back to the personal relationship that people have with themselves. Can I open my heart? Can I feel love inside myself? Can I accept the fact that my children have problems and that I am strong enough to be there to do something to help them? It's more than just a societal thing. It gets back to each and every individual human being. Now, I've been going around the country, and honestly, I hear so much about, one of the problems, I think, you do events, or I go to events, 95% of the people there are women. You can't get men to come to these events.
Men, why do you suppose that is?
Well, because I don't know.
Okay, fair enough.
I go.
Right.
But what happens is all the talk is about women rising, children, girls rising. And then I'm involved with an organization in New York. That's my organization. It's going to be about men rising. And we're going to try to approach some major celebrities and people like that about being involved in this. But
men rising up to speak out against these conditions.
These conditions, yeah. But my thought is that this has to be humanity rising. You know, I've been trained in ancient Buddhism, Hinduism. I've been trained in yin and yang and Shiva Shakti and yab yum and bringing together the masculine feminine, because I discovered in my own life through my own meditation practices that I can't function unless I bring together inside myself the male-female principles. You know, if one of them is missing, there's something deeply wrong with me. So I have to go inside, and I, over years of practicing meditation, I have discovered ways of unifying what the yin and the yang, or the Shiva Shakti, yab yam, and bringing together the masculine and feminine. Well, I think that it has to be humanity rising. It has to be all of people finally recognizing that we're dealing with one of the worst crimes of the 20th century. And unless people begin to feel a little outrage in themselves, I get a lot, what can I do? Mm-hmm. Well, as soon as somebody says to me, what can I do? I know there's not anything that they can do. When I heard about it, I started doing something. I started a safe house. I wrote a book. I'm traveling all over the country doing things to help. I got hooked up with organizations. I'm meeting people in the FBI, the police, all kinds of people. Well, you know, if you really want to do something, you will do something. If you have to ask, what can I do? And then somebody has to lay it out for you. 98% of the time, nothing gets done.
You're not really going to take that
next
step.
You're not going to really take the step.
But I think that there are, again, as people come out of numbing and realize the nature of the problem and feel that first sense of outrage, to honestly look around and say, what can be done to find a place for them in the struggle? I think sometimes it just takes that connection, that point of connection, because they have been overwhelmed, they have been numbed, and finally they are ready to dig into the issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're right, but you know, you can go to Google.
I'm a little optimistic.
You can go to Google, and there's hundreds of places there that are doing something about this.
Yeah.
And there's some in every city in the United States. People want to volunteer time, they can find a lot of stuff they can do, but they have to get that proactive energy in themselves. And I equate it with a little bit of outrage. How could this be going on in my world?
If you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. I think, as the bumper sticker says, and it's absolutely true.
And I think that people, if they feel that in themselves, and generally I've discovered it's like when it becomes something personal, people get outraged. You know, when it happens to their own family, you understand? You can read about it in the newspapers all you want, and it just goes right past you. But the day it happens to you, then suddenly something inside, then people begin to start foundations and institutions and doing all kinds of activist work and, you know, petitioning Congress. And, you know, they start, you know, somebody in somebody's family gets cancer, or they get, you know, some disease.
Right. It becomes reality when it happens to you.
When it hits home.
But it's time for everyone to realize it is reality now. And it is hitting home for 27 million. What was that?
27 million.
Million people.
All over the world.
That's reality.
That's reality. That equates to the Holocaust.
It's really unfathomable. It's an unfathomable number to me.
That's right.
Tomorrow, though, people can plug in and find out how they can get more involved in the struggle and see themselves as part of the solution. And that's happening again at the First Unitarian Church. And First Unitarian Church is at 1211 Southwest Main. And that's just in downtown Portland, 1211 Southwest Main. And it starts at 3 p.m. with the plenary session. U.S. Attorney General Amanda Marshall, speaking of modern-day slavery in Portland, and Oregon Representative Carolyn Tamai on current legislation that's happening. Stuart, thank you so much for joining us. Any last thoughts? We have just a couple minutes left. I know that the Little Sisters Foundation is becoming active in Oregon, mm-hmm. and that's been a journey we've followed here.
I do have one other thing, uh-huh. if we have a second.
Sure.
Okay. I decided that I don't want to preach to the choir anymore. The people that have to be touched are these children between the age of 13 and 18 years old. They have to be made aware of what's going on around them. So Chris and I sat down one day and we decided that what we're going to do is we're going to start producing music concerts, benefit concerts. You know, that'll do two things. It'll not the kind of music that I particularly want to hear, but the music that 13 to 18-year-old mm-hmm. kids want to hear. And it'll be a twofold thing. It'll be able to raise money for NGOs that are doing the work in the field. But even more importantly, it'll bring kids to a situation where they can be entertained and they can also, at the same time, get information and knowledge about what is going on around them.
Some direct outreach.
A direct outreach. And I thought, you know, every time I do these events, it's almost like preaching to the choir. Everybody that shows up knows about it. But it's got to get to the kids that are victims of this, that are really at risk all the time for this kind of thing. So we're going to start this project here in Portland. And if people out there want to get involved and they, you know, there are musicians and, you know, indie bands and this type mm-hmm. of thing that want to get involved, we'd be more than happy to talk to them. And
how would people get a hold of you?
Well, they can go to littlesistersfoundation.org and all the information is on, you know, the website, phone numbers, addresses, et cetera, et cetera.
Great. And then littlesistersfoundation.org.
.org.
Yes. And you can find out a lot more about everything Stuart's been talking about this morning on that website. And again, just one more time, tomorrow, 3 o'clock, First Unitarian Church starts a four-hour afternoon forum on child sex trafficking in Portland. Thank you very much for joining us this morning,
Stuart.
You're
welcome, Eddie. Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure, indeed. Good to talk to you. Thank you for your work.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9:59 a.m. Coming up at 10 is Air Cascaded with headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre, followed at 10:15 by Flashpoints on the Harvest. No, 64 years after Edward R. Murrow's Harvest of Shame broadcast, farmers, farm workers, and their families are still devastated by government policies. At 11 on the Digital Divide, host Rabia Yeaman speaks with Brad Burge of the MAPS organization about ongoing research in the clinical uses of psychedelics. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Anyone who is not a KBOO member can rectify that situation at kboo.fm, and they click where it says Donate Today. Stay tuned.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Friday, April 11th, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, KBOO.fm on the web. We're very, very fortunate today to have Ruth Wickler Loka, the curator and producer at Boom Arts, and Emily Mendelton, the guest director from New York City. There's a new play out. We're going to find out more about that in just a minute. If you have been following events that are unfolding in sub-Saharan Africa, and I assure you, these are earth-shaking events. These are top of the page, top of the fold, huge headlines, or they should be, but they aren't. Now, gee, I wonder why that is. Could this have something to do with the Southern Hemisphere being off the radar, and that people would be are far more interested in mudslides and Russians than the slaughter, for one thing, in the Democratic Republic of Congo of 6 million plus, right? 6 million plus, not to mention the massacre currently going on in the Central African Republic. Right there in the middle of this vortex, Rwanda and Uganda sit on top of the world's richest resource of minerals that is known to humankind. What we know is there is a fraction of what is likely still unproved in the ground. And the rest of the world, mud and Russians aside, has its beady little, and the Arctic aside, has its beady little eyes focused very intently on the Southern Hemisphere, even though it's not in the headlines. Before we get to this story, though, we've got a few headlines of our own to talk about. Officials with Oregon's Troubled Health Insurance Exchange say that they've narrowed the options to the site's future for down to two. They can switch to the federal exchange and stand alongside everybody at the White House saying bye-bye to Catherine Sebelius, or staying with the current technology and hiring a new contractor to fix it. Alas, there are many, many smaller exchanges dotted across the countryside who have already committed to the Oracle fiasco, and it's going to be costly and time-consuming for them to back out. Cover Oregon's interim chief information officer, Alex Petit, said yesterday that there's a third option, transferring technology from another state. He claims that would be too expensive and take too long. Compared to what? And Cascadia Forest Defenders, community volunteers want to express apologies because the owners of Seneca Jones Timber Company are the richest and most powerful people in Lane County. And so they're apologizing to Seneca Jones for bullying. I love Cascadia Forest Defenders. Always thinking ahead, possibly feathering his bed, too, so to speak, in the event that one day his actions will catch up with him and he'll find himself behind bars instead of in front of them. Governor Rick Perry has announced that Texas will not comply with the Prison Rape Elimination Act. Perry claims that reports of sexual abuse behind bars have decreased dramatically with Texas Safe Prisons Program. There's a program you certainly don't want to get with at any time in your life. Advocates and formerly incarcerated people, however, tell a different story. At the end of March, Governor Perry announced that the Texas Department of Criminal Justice will not comply with the Prison Rape Elimination Act. And going forward, we will see what voices raised in opposition to his folly will be able to accomplish, given that they're trying to accomplish it in the state of Texas. Oh, Boston. The bombing just keeps on going. A review of how the government's intelligence agencies handled information that they had before the Boston Marathon bombings last year concluded that it was impossible to know whether anything could have been done differently to prevent the attack, they say. I guess we'll never know, since they killed one of the main witnesses who could have, or in fact probably did tell the actual story in his hotel room in Florida. Unfortunately, he didn't make it through that interrogation alive. So I guess we won't be knowing all that much about the bombing. Whether information withheld by Russia until after the bombings could have made a difference was not addressed in an unclassified version of the report, even if the FBI had received details from the Russian wiretaps involving one of the bombing suspects. It's not clear that the U.S. government could have stopped him. Well, there's always... as we saw in Florida, there's always the sudden death during interrogation option. Israelis are cheating the Palestinian people out of their own taxes, which obviously are desperately needed to run the country. Yet another blow, as if the Palestinian people hadn't already enough to contend with. It's Israel's ugliest action yet since the U.S. peace talk charade led by John Kerry. The talks fool no one. These negotiations are meaningless because